In the summer of 1872, the 50-year-old Flaubert wrote to the literary salonist Edmond Roger de Genet, "I'm contemplating something in which I'll vent all my anger. Yes, at last I shall rid myself of what is stifling me. I shall vomit back onto my contemporaries the disgust they inspire in me, even if it means ripping my chest open." Hello, and welcome to Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. Flaubert's impulses described earlier would eventually become the novel Beauvoir and Boucher, his last novel, still unfinished when he died. Today, I'll be reading an excerpt from the opening of the novel, in which the titular characters, two middle-aged copy clerks, become fast friends after a chance meeting on a city bench. Considered Flaubert's masterpiece, Beauvoir and Boucher unravels the novel's realist tradition and sets the stage for the modernist innovations of Kafka, Joyce, and Beckett. I will be reading from the Dalkey Archive Press edition of the novel, translated by Mark Polizotti. Chapter 1. As the temperature that day had risen to 92 degrees, Boulevard Bourdon was completely deserted. Lower down, the Canal Saint-Martin's, contained by a lock at each end, stretched its inky water in a straight line. In the middle was a barge loaded with wood, and on the bank were twin rows of barrels. Past the canal, between buildings buttressed by scaffolding, emerged patches of clear blue sky, and beneath the sun's rays the white facades, slate roofs, and granite quays shone brilliantly. An indistinct murmur rose far off in the sultry atmosphere, and everything seemed muted by the Sunday quiet, the melancholy of summer afternoons. Two men appeared. One was coming from the Bastille, the other from the Jardin des Plantes. The taller one, wearing a linen suit, walked with his hat pushed back, vest unbuttoned and tie in his hand. The shorter one, whose body disappeared inside a brown frock coat, lowered his head beneath a cap with a pointed visor. When they reached the middle of the boulevard, they both sat down at the same moment on the same bench. To wipe their foreheads, they removed their hats, which each man placed next to him. The short man noticed the name Beauvoir written in his neighbor's, while the latter made out the word Boucher in the cap belonging to the fellow in the coat. "Fancy that," he said. "We both had the idea of writing our names in our hats." "I should say so. Someone could walk off with mine at the office." "You don't say. I work at an office, too." At which point they looked at each other. Boucher was immediately charmed by Beauvoir's friendly appearance. His bluish, heavily lidded eyes smiled on his florid face. His trousers, which puckered at the cuff over buckskin shoes, had a wide flap in front that molded his stomach and caused his shirt to puff out at the belt line. And his blonde hair, waving into soft curls, made him look like an overgrown child. His lips gave off a kind of low, continual whistle. Beauvoir was struck by Boucher's serious demeanor. He seemed to be wearing a wig, so flat and black was the hair covering his high skull. His long nose made his face seem in constant profile. His legs, encased in twill stovepipes, were disproportionate to the length of his torso, and he had a strong, cavernous voice. He let out a sigh. It would be so much nicer in the country. But, according to Beauvoir, the suburbs were impossible because of all the noise from the dance hall. Boucher felt the same way. Still, he was getting tired of the capital. Beauvoir, too. And their eyes wandered over the heaps of paving stones, the hideous water in which a bundle of straw was floating, the smokestack of a factory rising up from the horizon. The sewers gave off a fetid stench. When they turned around, they saw only the walls of the municipal granary. All things considered, and Pouchet found this surprising, it was hotter in the streets than at home. Bovard encouraged him to remove his coat. Personally, he couldn't care less what people thought. Suddenly, a drunk zigzagged across the sidewalk, and from the topic of laborers, they launched into a discussion of politics. They were of the same opinion, though Bovard was perhaps a bit more liberal. A clanking noise rang out on the cobblestones in a cloud of dust. It was three hackney cabs heading towards Bercy, carrying a bride with her bouquet, some bourgeois in white tie, ladies sunk to the armpits in their skirts, two or three little girls, and a student. The sight of this wedding led Bovard and Pouchet to talk of women, whom they declared to be frivolous, shrewdish, and stubborn. That being said, they were often better than men, and at other times seemed worse. In short, you were better off living without them. Pouchet, for his part, had remained a bachelor. "I'm a widower myself," said Bovard. "No children." "Perhaps that's just as well. Ultimately, though, living alone could get rather depressing." Then, at the edge of the quay, a prostitute appeared with a soldier. Ashen-faced, dark-haired, and pitted with smallpox, she was leaning on the military man's arm, dragging her worn-out heels and swinging her hips. When she passed by, Bovard made a smutty remark. Pouchet turned to beet red, and no doubt to avoid answering, he glanced pointedly at a priest who was coming their way. The clergyman slowly walked down the avenue of thin elms lining the sidewalk, and Bovard expressed relief once the man's tricorn hat was no longer in sight, for he despised Jesuits. Pouchet, without quite absolving them, showed some deference for religion. Meanwhile, dusk was beginning to fall, and some window blinds facing them had been raised. The passerby increased in number. 7 o'clock sounded. Their words flowed tirelessly, remarks following upon anecdotes, philosophical musings upon personal observations. They denigrated the Public Works Department, the Tobacco Authority, business, the theater, our Navy, and the entire human race, like men who had suffered grave disappointments. Each one, listening to the other, rediscovered forgotten parts of himself. And although they had passed the age of naive emotions, they both felt a new pleasure, a kind of blossoming, the charm of affections newly born. 20 times they had stood up, sat down again, and had walked the length of the boulevard from upstream lock to downstream, each time meaning to take their leave but unable to, retained by a kind of fascination. They had nonetheless shaken hands and were about to part company when Bovard blurted out, "How about having dinner together?" "I was thinking the same thing," answered Pouchet, "but I didn't dare suggest it." And he let himself be led to a cozy little restaurant opposite the town hall. Bovard asked for the menu. Pouchet shied away from spices as if they would set his body on fire. This became the subject of a medical discussion, after which they praised the advances of science. "So many things to know, so much research. If only one had the time. Alas, one's livelihood absorbed it all." Their arms flew up in amazement and they nearly hugged each other across the table when they discovered that they were both copy clerks. Bovard in a business office, Pouchet at the Naval Ministry, which didn't keep him from devoting a few moments to his studies every night. He had noted some errors in Mr. Thier's book, and spoke with the highest respect of a certain Professor Domachel. Bovard had the advantages in other respects. His horsehair watch chain and the way he stirred the remoulade sauce bespoke an experienced man of the world. And while he ate, the corner of his napkin tucked under his armpit, he spouted forth observation that made Pouchet laugh. It was a peculiar laugh, A single low note, always the same, emitted at long intervals. Bovard's was continuous and resonant and uncovered his teeth. It made his shoulders shake and the patrons near the door turn around. When the meal was over, they went somewhere else for coffee. Pouchet, glancing at the gas lights, deplored this conspicuous luxury, then offhandedly dismissed the newspapers. Bovard was more intelligent. He liked writers in general, and in his youth had leaned towards becoming an actor. He tried to do balancing tricks with the billiard cue and two ivory balls, like his friend Barbaroux. They invariably fell to the floor and rolled away, getting lost among people's legs. The waiter, who got up each time to go fetch them on all fours, ended up complaining. Pouchet quarreled with him, and when the owner appeared, ignored his pleas and even quibbled over the bill. He then suggested they finish their evening peacefully at his place, which was just a short walk away on the Rue Saint-Martin. No sooner had they entered than Pouchet put on a kind of print flannel nightshirt, then showed Bovard around his apartment. The corners of a pine desk, placed in the center of the room, made it difficult to circulate, and all around in haphazard piles, on shelves, on the three chairs, on the old couch, and in the corners, were several volumes of the Roré Encyclopedia, the Hypnotist Manual, something by Fénelon, and other books, along with stacks of paper, two coconuts, various medallions, a fez, and shells bought back from Le Havre by Domochel. A coating of dust gave a velvety finish to the walls, which had once been painted yellow. A shoe brush was lying at the foot of the bed, whose sheets hung to the floor. On the ceiling, one could see a large black stain produced by smoke from the lamp. Bovard, no doubt because of the smell, asked if he could open a window. "My papers will blow all over the place," cried Pouchet, who was also afraid of drafts. Still, he was panting in that little room, heated since morning by the slate roofing. Bovard said, "If I were you, I'd take off that flannel." "What?" Pouchet hung his head, terrified of the idea of being without his protective wrap. "Walk me home," Bovard proposed. "The fresh air will make you feel cooler." Finally, Pouchet put his boots back on, grumbling, "I swear you're a regular sorcerer." And despite the distance, he accompanied his new friend all the way home, which was at the corner of the Rue des Bethunes, facing the Pont des Tournelles. Bovard's room was well scrubbed and had percale curtains, walnut furniture, and a balcony with a view of the river. The two main decorations were a liquor service in the middle of the sideboard and daguerreotypes of friends lined up along the mirror. An oil painting hung in the alcove. "My uncle's," said Bovard, and the candle in his hand lit a gentleman's features. Red whiskers widened his face, crowned by a head of hair that frizzed into a point. He was ensconced in a high cravat, a shirt with a triple collar, a velvet vest, and a black coat. Diamonds had been painted on his jabot. His eyes were slanted at the cheeks, and his smile looked vaguely sardonic. Pouchet couldn't help remarking, "That could be your father." "He's my godfather," Bovard replied offhandedly, adding that he had been baptized François Denis Bartholomew. Pouchet's given names were Juste Romain Cyril. They are even the same age, 47. This coincidence pleased them, but also surprised them. Each had thought the other somewhat older. Afterward, they spoke admiringly of Providence, which sometimes worked in such marvelous ways. "For if we hadn't gone out early to take a walk, we might have died without ever meeting." And, having exchanged their work addresses, they bid each other good night. "Don't go chasing the ladies now," Bovard shouted down the stairwell. Pouchet continued down the steps without answering the off-color remark. The next day, in the courtyard of Descombos Bros, The next day, in the courtyard of Descombobro Alstatian Fabrics, 92 Rue Hautefeuille, a voice called out, "Bovard, Monsieur Bovard." The latter poked his head out around the glass tiles and recognized Pouchet, who said more loudly, "I'm not sick. I took it off." "What's that?" "This," said Pouchet, pointing to his chest. The previous day's talk, along with the temperatures in the apartment and the labors of digestion, had prevented him from sleeping, until, unable to stand it any longer, he had removed his nightshirt and flung it aside. In the morning, he remembered what he had done, saw that there had been no ill effects, and had come to notify Bovard, who as a result had risen to even greater heights in his esteem. Pouchet was the son of a small shopkeeper and had never known his mother, who died very young. At 15, they had taken him out of boarding school to place him in a real estate office. The police arrived one day and carted his boss off to prison, a terrible episode that still filled him with horror. After that, he had tried out several occupations: student of pharmacology, school teacher, an accountant on a steamship on the Upper Seine. Finally, a division chief, taken with his handwriting, had hired him as an administrative copy clerk. But his awareness of his own sporadic education and intellectual shortcomings darkened his mood, so that he lived completely alone, having neither parents nor a mistress. His one diversion was his Sunday outings to inspect public work projects. Bovard's earliest memories carried him back to a farm on the banks of the Loire. A man, his uncle, had brought him to Paris to teach him business. When he came of age, he was given several thousand francs, and with this he took a wife and opened a confectioner's shop. 6 months later, his bride disappeared along with the cash box. Friends, high living, and especially laziness had hastened his ruin. But he had the inspiration to use his beautiful penmanship, and so for the last 12 years he held the same job at Descombobro Fabrics, 92 Rue Hautefeuille. As for his uncle, who, years ago, had sent him the famous portrait as a souvenir, Bovard did not even know his whereabouts, and he no longer expected anything from him. £1,500 in annuities and his wages as a copy clerk afforded him the opportunity to doze off every evening in a cheap tavern. Their meeting, then, took on the significance of a great adventure. From the start, they were bound to each other by hidden threads. Besides, how can we explain why any two people hit it off? Why is a certain peculiarity, a certain imperfection, indifferent or baneful in one person, but enchanting in someone else? What we call love at first sight holds true for all sorts of passions. By the end of the week, they were calling each other by their first names. Often, they went to meet each other at work. The moment one appeared, the other shut his desk, and off they went together to roam the streets. Bovard advanced with huge strides, while Pouchet, multiplying his steps, his frock coat beating against his heels, seemed to be gliding on rollers. In the same way, their personal tastes were complementary. Bovard smoked a pipe, was fond of cheese, and had his espresso daily. Pouchet took snuff, had only a bit of preserves for dessert, and dipped a cube of sugar into his coffee. One was confident, rash, generous. The other discreet, pensive, frugal. As a friendly gesture, Bovard offered to introduce Pouchet to Barbaroux. The latter was a former traveling salesman, now a stockbroker, very good-natured, a patriot and a ladies' man, who affected popular slang in his speech. Pouchet found him irritating and took Bovard to see Domochel. The author, for he had published a brief mnemonic, taught literature in a primary school, had orthodox opinions, and dressed conservatively. He bored Bovard to tears. Neither had concealed his opinion from the other. Each one recognized its merits. Their habits changed, and, foregoing their usual boarding house meals, they ended up eating together every day. They commented on the fashionable plays of the moment, the government, the price of food, business scandals. From time to time, the diamond necklace affair or the Fualdès trial surfaced in their conversation. Then they debated the causes of the revolution. They visited the Art and Crafts Conservatory, Saint-Denis Church, the Gobelins Tapestry Mill, the Invalides, and all the public museums. When asked for their identification papers, they pretended to have lost them, claiming to be two foreigners, two Englishmen. In the galleries of the Natural History Museum, they passed in astonishment before the stuffed quadrupeds, in pleasure before the butterflies, in indifference before the metals. The fossils set them dreaming. Conchology bored them. They examined the hothouses through the glass and shuddered to think that all those leaves distilled poisons. What they admired most about the cedar tree was that it had been transported there in a hat. At the Louvre, they did their best to admire Raphael. At the National Library, they wanted to know the exact number of volumes. Once they wandered into a course on Arabic at the Collège de France, and the professor was astounded to see those two strangers struggling to take notes. Thanks to Barbaroux, they were admitted backstage at a small theater. They learned about discoveries, read prospectuses, and their newfound curiosity caused their intelligence to bloom. On a horizon that receded further each day, they glimpsed things at once strange and wondrous. Admiring an old piece of furniture, they regretted not having lived at a time when it was used, even though they knew absolutely nothing about the period. Certain names evoked images of countries that were all the more beautiful and that they could say nothing specific about them. Books whose titles were unintelligible to them seemed to contain untold mysteries. And, having more ideas, they suffered more acutely. When a mail coach passed by in the street, they felt an urge to leave with it. The flower stalls of the Quai aux Fleurs made them long for the countryside. One Sunday they set out early in the morning, and, passing through Meudon, Bellevue, Sernay, and Autou, they spent the entire day roaming on foot among the vineyards, picking poppies at the edge of the fields, drinking fresh milk, eating beneath the acacias of country inns. They returned home very late, dusty, exhausted, and delighted. They took many more such walks, but felt so sad the next day that they finally gave them up. The monotony of office life became odious. Always the scraper and pounce, the same inkwell, the same pens and office mates. Deeming the latter to be stupid, they spoke to them less and less, which earned them some teasing. Every day, they arrived late and were reprimanded. Once they had almost been happy, but their trade humiliated them now that they held themselves in higher esteem, and they goaded each other on in their disgust, flattered each other, spoiled each other. Pouchet adopted Beauvoir's abruptness. Beauvoir took on some of Pouchet's moroseness. "I'd rather be a juggler in the town square," said one. "You might as well be a ragman," cried the other. What an abominable situation, and not even the hope of escaping. The chapter ends with Beauvoir receiving a letter inviting him to the reading of the last will and testament of his father, where he discovers that the man who he thought was his uncle, whose painting he had hanging in his apartment, was actually his father, who, along with his last will and testament, archive press bequeaths him £15,000 a year. Dictionary of accepted ideas. Use the money to retire to the countryside catalog of fashionable and use their newfound leisure time to satisfy their curiosity about all the things they'd been too busy to study in the city. Most of those studies make it into the novel, reflecting Flaubert's copious research. Each of Flaubert's novels required vast amounts of research, but Beauvoir and Pouchet took this to new heights. In preparation for the novel, he famously read some 1,500 volumes, with huge portions of his research ending up on the cutting room floor, and entire months of pursuing specialized work, sometimes yielding only a paragraph or two of text. However, much of the research discarded by the novel found its way into Flaubert's Dictionary of Accepted Ideas and the previously untranslated Catalogue of Fashionable Ideas, both of which are contained in the Dalkey Archive Press edition of the novel. As the translator's note describes, the dictionary distills the novel's content and unseasonable sense of humor into a wide canvas of attitudes and opinions, at once risible and deeply rooted. Flaubert stressed that he meant for the dictionary to be ironic and hilarious from start to finish. The catalog of fashionable ideas is less exhaustive than the dictionary, and is translated here for the first time by Mark Polizotti. The novel includes a preface by Raymond Queneau, which ends with a quote pulled from one of Flaubert's letters. Yes, stupidity consists in wanting to conclude. We are a thread and we want to know the pattern. That goes back to those internal discussions about the decadence of art. Now one spends one's time telling oneself, we are completely finished. Here we are, at the very end, etc., etc. What mind of any strength, beginning with Homer, has ever come to a conclusion? And on that note, we end today's episode of Dalkey Archive Press's Black on White. Thank you for listening.